This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July the 29th, 2021. Welcome to Now with Dave Brown, coming to you on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Dave Brown. Let's hit the horns and go. Coming up on the show today, AMI communications specialist Greg David will tell you about a wide range of new documentaries coming to AMI TV in August. Producer Don Dickinson will preview The Guardian this week with an article about an Alabama woman who is facing felony charges for filling a doctor's prescription while pregnant. Stephen Scott of Double Tap Canada will describe a new device that harvests sweat from your fingertips to generate power. I never knew that I was a personal hydroelectric dam. I might have a good side hustle here. And Sylvie Fiquette shares the Pacific Regional Report and chats about Camp Bowen's Virtual Connections summer programming. A busy show coming your way today on this Thursday, but let's begin with our top story of the day, an update on COVID-19. Instead of starting in Canada, I'm actually going to start abroad today. With the Olympics underway, Tokyo has reported record-breaking COVID-19 cases for the third straight day. Karen Chamis looks at the numbers.
Government officials have said that new cases were soaring not only in the Tokyo area but across the country. The number of positive cases has doubled in a week, setting an all-time high since the pandemic began early last year. Whilst Japan has continuously kept its cases low, recently its weekly average has shot to 88 per 100,000 in Tokyo. This compares to 18.5 in the United States and 48 in Britain. Japan's top medical advisor says the biggest risk is a lack of a sense of crisis. I'm Karen Chamas.
And then coming back to Canada, let's look at our case numbers, which are also ticking upwards. Currently, there are 5,459 active cases of the virus in Canada. 26,570 people have died. COVID-19 restrictions are being tightened in the central Okanagan area of British Columbia's Interior Health Region in order to curb infections that are rising primarily due to unvaccinated and partially vaccinated residents. The region's chief medical health officer, Dr. Sue Pollock, says non-essential travel is being discouraged unless people are fully vaccinated, and it's time to take a few steps back to control the spread of infection.
Effective tonight at midnight, Interior Health is placing a medical health officer regional mandatory mask order for all public indoor spaces for the central Okanagan communities of Peachland, West Kelowna, Kelowna, Lake Country, West Bank First Nation lands, and the electoral districts of the central Okanagan regional district.
Enforcement will be enhanced at restaurants. Nightclubs can remain open with 10 people seated at tables, but dancing is not allowed and masks must be worn at gyms. Over to Alberta, where their top doctor says the province will start lifting COVID-19 restrictions on Friday, despite a rise in cases. Dr. Dina Hinshaw says the threat of the virus is shifting.
While COVID-19 cases may rise in the coming weeks and months, a surge of hospitalizations and other severe outcomes is much less likely thanks to vaccines. I know that the rise in cases over the last week has created some anxiety in some people. After all, we have been closely watching case counts for well over a year.
Hinshaw says the province will no longer require mandatory quarantine for close contacts of positive COVID cases. Isolation, however, will still be required for anyone with symptoms and for confirmed positive cases. And just to give a bit more context in regards to those rising numbers in Alberta, yesterday, Alberta added more cases than Ontario. Alberta has a third of the population of Ontario. Premier Doug Ford says Ontario's back to school plan will be announced early next week. Ford says air quality is a priority.
Making sure that we increase the protocols to make sure the 2 million kids that are going back to school are going to be safe, and as well as the teachers. Changing everything from the HEPA filters to making sure they have proper ventilation in the schools.
There was proper ventilation at that press conference. Increased air quality was one of the recommendations of the province's advisory group of science experts, who also called for schools to remain open in all but the most catastrophic scenarios. Let's look at the vaccination story across Canada. The provinces and territories administered over 275,000 doses of vaccine yesterday. 80.3% of eligible Canadians have received one shot. 64.7% of eligible Canadians are fully vaccinated. Another related story to COVID, it's not urgent, but Canadian Blood Services is keeping a close eye on blood product levels this summer. Spokeswoman Tracy Smith says blood demand dropped during the pandemic, but now surgeries are resuming in many provinces and the demand has gone up. She says one area of concern is the level of type O negative blood, which is usually used in emergency rooms.
Before the summer, before things started to open up, we had our ideal O negative supply, which was between 5 and 8 days we like to be at for a supply. And we've seen over the last month and a half that's dropped down. Right now, we're sitting at just over a 4-day supply.
Smith says restrictions remain inside donor clinics, but the hours have been extended to try and keep up with demand. And then let's go south of the border, where U.S. President Joe Biden is blaming unvaccinated Americans for the surge of the Delta variant of the coronavirus. Sagar Magani files this report.
The president says the pandemic now is one of the unvaccinated, and he's urging them to get the shots.
Please. Please, please, please.
His announcement today on vaccinations for federal workers reflects the reality that his earlier pleas have not led to the nation reaching his vaccination goals. He'd aimed to have 70% of adults with at least one shot by July 4th. It's now 69%. 60% are fully vaccinated. A recent APNORC Center for Public Affairs Research poll found 45% of those who have not been vaccinated say they definitely will not be. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Let's get to our daily polls. At AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter. Accessible Media Inc. is where you find us on Facebook. On Wednesday, we asked you, should a discount be given to customers who use self-checkout at stores? 63% of you said yes, 37% of you said no. Alan wrote this tweet in, and this is a brilliant, brilliant point in regard to accessibility. Alan writes, only if they allow people who can't use the self-checkout register to... Only if they allow people who cannot use the self-checkout to register for the discount as well. So he votes no. And then Karen writes in, I like them on days when I don't want to talk to anybody. That's reward enough for me. Yes, self-checkout is a great way to remain antisocial. I will agree with that through and through. At AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook is where you find today's daily poll. Have you tried outdoor fitness classes? Yes, no, or I'd like to. Sam, you strike me as the type who might have given an outdoor fitness class a crack, maybe an outdoor yoga class?
Not even during the pandemic. I've let it fall by the wayside. I really do not like doing Zoom fitness classes. But also, I know that there's been a bunch of yoga in the park, and I've been tempted, let's just say. But no, the one thing that I will actually probably be making use of is, and I think this does count as an outdoor fitness class, is a running group.
I would count that as an outdoor fitness class.
Yeah, I was always a runner, but I hate running in the street, so I can't wait for either a running group to take on a trail to go as a mass group. I don't like runners who run on the sidewalks in like, you know, dense urban areas. I don't think it's what it's for. And it makes me nervous. So I missed my treadmill. But I think that's going to be a good way to get out a little bit more.
Yeah, definitely. There are lots of fitness opportunities you can do solo, right? Like obviously you can ride your bike, you can go for runs, you can go for walks. You can even just sort of do your own thing in the park if you want to. But I'm sort of referring here to specific classes like park boot camps, which have become quite popular during the pandemic, but they were popular even before the pandemic kicked in. Yeah. A few of my lawyer friends out in Vancouver used to do it on their lunch hours all the time. They would go out there and get a workout in, and what's cool is their office had a shower. I was like, now that's living right there. Your office has a shower.
My only gripe about it, though, too, is that there are, like, these are a lot of public parks that are getting used for public fitness classes, and that there are regulations about how they're used. And I think that most of the ones that I've seen in the parks recently have not been, at least in Toronto, you have to pay money to even host a fitness class in a public park. But I don't think that's been happening as much. And I think that's fine. I don't want to be like a stickler for just that kind of thing.
Compliance Robinson over
but
here.
But I don't want to say that they're just for anybody to use. They're for everybody to use, yeah. Not just people who are doing the fitness class.
That's fair. That's well put. Let's bring in Nazreen Abdelmajid. Nazreen, I know you missed the gym a lot during the pandemic. Have you considered an outdoor fitness class?
I've considered it. However, I like my own pace. So being part of a class just pressures me to catch up to other people. But for example, if my knee hurts or something like that, I like going my own pace, you know, pausing, taking deep breath or whatever. Mm-hmm. I've tried Zumba classes before. I've tried one and it was too much pressure for me and I had to get out of it. But I've seen my friend do a outdoor fitness class outside of in Toronto, right outside of the CN Tower, like at a park. I think it was Gardens Park or something like that. But it looks sick. It looks so much fun. Mm-hmm. There's so many people and the weather's nice. So it looks awesome. The view's nice. I've considered it.
One of the things that used to be really cool in the summertime in Ottawa is that on Wednesdays at lunch hour, they would do yoga on Parliament Hill, which was always this great visual aesthetic where you'd get people from filing out of their offices and going out and doing yoga.
But Nazreen, it's motivating.
Nazreen, I'm kind of like you. I don't like somebody yelling at me, like an instructor yelling at me while I'm working out. I've become very much a solo operation of working out.
Yeah.
And it's different when you're weightlifting and it's a spotter yelling at you because it's like your friend who's yelling at you.
Yeah,
you know, it's different.
Exactly.
I don't like random instructors, you know, getting up my grill.
Don't tell me what to do.
Let me be me. I promise you, if I stick to this, I will lose 1 pound. I assure you. Nazreen, thank you for this. Let's bring in Mike Ross. Mike, have you ever considered jumping into an... I know you have some workout gear in your basement, but have you ever considered an outdoor fitness class?
No.
To put it bluntly.
Yeah. I haven't been in a fitness class, if you want to put it that way, since... Oh, I think I was in grade 10, grade 11. I was in our high school's aerobics club. And that was great. I mean, I really enjoyed it and I was good at it, but I'm kind of with Nisreen. When I'm exercising for the purpose of exercising, not out playing golf or playing ball or whatever, but when I'm exercising, I kind of like just being in my own little bubble. I don't really like being around other people while I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And I especially try to avoid, anywhere where I'm going to feel judged. And I feel like if I'm out in a park somewhere, boy, is there judgment.
Oof, there's gawkers. There's gawkers
no,
everywhere.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, thank you. Besides, you're going to get halfway through that fitness class and suddenly you're going to hear the jingle jangle of the ice cream truck. And it's all going to be for naught.
As I've told you guys before, I've gone through phases of my life where fitness was a pretty big deal for me. There have been times in my life where I've had six-pack abs. Those were a long, long time ago. But I do recall when I lived in Toronto in 2011, and I said to myself, okay, it's time to really crank up the getting in shape this summer. You're doing some work on TV. It's time to, like, look the part for the people that you're working with. So I ended up signing up for one of these nice gyms on the Danforth, and they had all kinds of classes included with your membership. And I did a Pilates class that I liked, and I did a yoga class that I liked. And then I saw this one class called Cardio Pump. And I'm like, ooh, that sounds like quite the class for me. That sounds like an opportunity for me to get in incredible shape. So I kind of walk in on a Friday afternoon and I'm feeling good. And I look around and I see just like nothing but like super fit women. And I was like, ooh, okay, maybe I've overstepped my bounds a little bit. Like maybe this isn't the class for me. And I'm like, okay, well, we're just going to do it. We're just going to go give this a crack as it stands. And, I say to the instructor, listen, it's my first day. I don't know what I'm doing. She's like, oh, don't worry. Just keep up with us. Just grab a 5 pound dumbbell and you'll be fine. And I was like, 5 pounds? I mean, I bench press like a couple hundred pounds. Like 5 pound dumbbell doesn't sound like a lot. Let's give that a crack. So I grab these 5 pound dumbbells and I'm thinking this is going to be the easiest workout that I've ever had in my entire life. 8 minutes into this workout, I'm panting. I'm dying. I'm sweating. I can't lift the 5 pounds anymore. And everybody else in the room is just like crushing it and killing it and looking great. And I hung my head in shame and walked out and said, cardio pump, not for me. And I think that was the last like truly intense class that I've ever done in regards to group fitness. And we have never since gone back. And the evidence shows in the pant size and belt size that I wear these days. Mike, thank you for that. Nazreen, Sam, thank you guys as well. At AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook is where you track us down. Have you ever considered trying an outdoor fitness class? Let's go back to Nazreen Abdelmajid. She's going to tell you whether the weather will allow you to do an outdoor fitness class today.
Thanks, Dave. Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. In St. John's, mainly cloudy, chance of showers or drizzle, then clearing, fog patches dissipating, high of 23, except a high of 18 along parts of the coast and a humidex of 28. In Halifax, mainly sunny, high of 24, except a high of 18 along parts of the coast. Montreal, mix of sun and clouds, becoming cloudy with showers, a high of 25 and a humidex of 27. In Ottawa, cloudy, 60% chance of showers, there's a risk of a thunderstorm, high of 22 and a humidex of 26. Toronto, cloudy, showers, there's a risk of a thunderstorm, then hazy, with a high of 22 and a humidex of 27. Thunder Bay, mix of sun and clouds, some smoke, locally becoming hazy, high of 25 and a humidex of 27. In Winnipeg, sunny, hazy, high of 28 and a humidex of 30. Saskatoon, sunny, cloudiness increasing, then a chance of showers, there's a risk of thunderstorms and hazy, high of 29 and a humidex of 30. Calgary, mix of sun and clouds, then hazy, high of 28 and a humidex of 32. Edmonton, mix of sun and clouds, becoming sunny and hazy with a high of 29 and a humidex of 31. Moving to Yellowknife, cloudy, chance of showers, then clearing with a high of 20. Vancouver, sunny, high of 26 and a humidex of 30. And in Victoria, sunny, high of 27 and a humidex of 32. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
So Nazreen, I was keeping score there. It sounds like Yellowknife's the only place where you want to do an outdoor exercise class today.
Yes, the rest is not an outdoorsy day.
Nazreen, you know what I'm talking about though with those cardio pump classes, right? Like it looks so easy and then it's so hard.
That's the thing. I always think it's so easy. For example, the treadmill, there's always in rows and the guy in front of me is doing 25 minutes. I'm out here 4 minutes later and I'm sweating through this mask. I think
you've told me before though, you like to unknowingly compete with other people. Like you won't tell them that you're competing with them, but you'll be like, oh, I'm coming for you.
I can do more than 25 minutes. Are you kidding? Nope.
Nazreen, we'll talk to you a little bit later.
Yes, for sure.
That's Nazreen Abdelmajid. Coming up next, AMI Communications Specialist Greg David will tell you about a wide range of new documentaries coming to AMI TV in August. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. You see and hear the manifestation of the daily grind on this show every day. We've come your way 5 days a week throughout the pandemic, and we're proud of the work that we do. But our colleagues around the country have been grinding too, and you don't necessarily get to see that manifestation on a daily basis, but they work on a slew of awesome documentaries and incredible programming for AMI TV. And this August, AMI TV is going to be debuting a large roster of new and original documentary programming to soak up that last bit of the summer season. Joining us now to tell you more is Greg David. Greg is a communications specialist for AMI, and he joins us from the Quebec side of the Ottawa River in Gatineau. Hey, good morning, Greg. Great to chat with you once again.
Great to chat with you. Boy, you've been away the last few Fridays I've been on. I was thinking the show was going to be called Now with Dave Mike Ross. I was getting worried.
I put it in my contract. I said I will not talk to Greg David in the summer. But it's actually been the reverse. I actually demanded. I said I have not spoken to Greg David enough this summer, and I got to get him on the show. Exactly. Get him back into my life. So, Greg, as I mentioned off the top, it's really a never-ending production of content here at AMI TV. AMI is going to have 9 new documentaries. So before you highlight some of them, can you tell us how AMI was able to get all these done amidst a global pandemic?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it has been tough. I mean, if you speak to any of the producers, anybody involved in any of these projects, they'll say that this has been an unprecedented challenge. And quite frankly, the way that they've done it is by evolving and trying new things. So some of the interviews may have been done via Zoom. A lot of them were done, outside, people wearing masks and making sure that the social distancing was going on. And of course, you know, depending on the local area where it was filmed, they were adhering to strict COVID-19 precautions. So that's kind of the short answer.
Yeah, I know the bureaus have been working their tails off trying to get this done under serious restrictions. Really only the technical people being able to come in and get equipment when necessary, but otherwise having to work out of the home office is no small feat. I've worked on a lot of documentaries over the years, and not being there shoulder to shoulder with your colleagues and sort of brainstorming stuff together, difficult. It's a big kudos to all our colleagues across the country who've been putting that work in. So you want to start by telling us about a documentary called Anna Kwan. Who was Anna, and what makes her story so unique?
Yeah, one of the interesting things and one of the great things about the AMI documentaries are that they're from different areas of the country, you know, like our bureaus, like you mentioned. So Anna Kwan is based out in Nova Scotia, and she describes herself as mad, mobility challenged, middle-aged, and a mixed race artist who has found salvation through art. So through this documentary that's going to be broadcast Wednesday, August the 18th at 8 p.m. Eastern on AMI TV, you're going to learn a lot more about Anna Kwan and the art and how she does it on a regular basis.
Oh, very cool. Always like hearing inside the minds of artists and learning more about their process.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, over to the next documentary. It's called Blind Adventures with Ron Walsh. Walsh, how adventurous are we talking here?
Yeah, this guy's a character, and we're heading to Saskatchewan for this one. Ron Walsh, who is blind, is participating in outdoor activities like hiking, canoeing, cross-country skiing, and he's doing it all with his friends. That one's showing up Tuesday, August the 10th at 8 p.m. Eastern on AMI TV, and it's three episodes, and in the first one, they head out, Ron and a bunch of his friends head out on a hike into the Saskatchewan wilds to look for... Well, it's an old hunting blind that Ron Walsh built years and years ago, 10 years ago. Now, it might not sound that adventurous, but it is adventurous because they're contending with, of course, you know, how do you hike through the brush when you're a white cane user, when you're blind? And so they're showing you how to do that, but also the entertainment value is unprecedented because Ron Walsh is quite the character. So they go hiking in the first episode, canoeing in the second one, and then a little bit of cross-country skiing in the third one.
Sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds kind of aspirational, some things that I think a few folks might want to get up to here in the next couple of weeks before summer goes away or even when winter rolls around, getting that cross-country skiing in. Okay, on August the 25th, we have Chris Koch making life happen. What's Chris Koch going to be having us learn about?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one. Chris, he's a traveler, he's a farmer, he's a motivational speaker, and he's an athlete. He's dived with sharks, he's run marathons, and he's hitchhiked solo across Canada. You name it, he's probably done it. But there is one difference. Chris doesn't have arms or legs. So in Chris Koch, Make Life Happen, you're going to meet Chris, you're going to meet his family, and you're going to learn a lot more about this guy who, you know, I don't know whether, who's just doing all these things and, gets on with life. We're showing some images right now of him water skiing and skateboarding. And so you're going to learn a lot more about Chris and his life on Wednesday, August the 25th at 8 p.m. Eastern on AMI TV.
And then going back to the art range, some folks are going to be very familiar with the name, the voice, and the face of Amy Amante. Of course, she's a film reviewer for us on the show. She's a community reporter. She also has her podcast, Access Art with Amy. But she's going to have a special coming up called Art Form. So what can you tell us about Art Form?
Yeah, I mean, you just mentioned Amy wears so many hats, and here she is, doing this two-part series, documentary series called Art Form out in Vancouver. And so she's going to be exploring the art in, there's going to be two episodes. So in the first episode, she's exploring art and creativity of hip-hop music through the experiences of musicians with disabilities. And then in the second half hour, she's going to explore sculpture and three-dimensional art through conversations with artists with disabilities. And Art Form is going to debut back-to-back episodes on Friday, August the 27th at 8 and 8:30 p.m. Eastern on AMI TV.
Oh, gosh. The more Amy Amante on your screen and your ears and in your eyes, the better. I always enjoy catching up with Amy, no matter what kind of art she's taking a closer look at. Greg, this one, next one, I know a little bit about because earlier this summer, we had a chance to speak with Sherry Hensigan about the 60th anniversary program at Lake Joe, Camp Lake Joseph for a CNIB. What are some of the memories that we're going to get captured in this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people that are already know about Lake Joe will know about the history of it. For somebody like me, I'm going to check this out because I didn't realize that that Camp Joe has been around since the 1950s, mm-hmm. and it's really become a rite of passage for thousands of kids. And so in this AMI documentary, we're going to capture the essence of CNIB Lake Joe, where the lessons and the laughter are carried in the hearts and memories long after camp has ended. And the official name of the title of the documentary is called Ripples, CNIB Lake Joe, and it's going to debut on Friday, August the 6th at 8 p.m. Eastern on AMI TV.
Greg, have you had the chance to go up there and visit yet for any kind of promotional or marketing events since you joined the AMI family?
No, I haven't. Elena Falcone from the marketing and communications department went up a few years ago to do a photo shoot. It was right after I had started, so I didn't have enough pull in the company to actually take a road trip. But, you know, I've driven past the exit, and I've always wanted to go there, and so it's on my bucket list for sure.
When we had Sherry on the show, I mentioned a couple times that I've had an opportunity to do a few stories up there, a couple of the youth camps, a chance to meet a bunch of the campers and the instructors, and it was super, super cool. And I've had the chance to work at a couple fundraisers up there as well over the years, and they do a really amazing job. And even for someone like myself, who's not necessarily an outdoorsy person, it's like right. The perfect glamping life for me. If I can get running water and a lake and like and cottage living, like now we found the sweet spot for me.
Yeah, glamping. That's the word. I like that. I used to camp, and now I like to glamp.
It's also, if you go back, I think it was in the summer of 2016 we did the story. I think that's the last time I've had my shirt off on camera, and it's quite a sight to behold as I splashed into the lake and tried to not ruin Darcy DeTone's camera as we did that. Hey, Greg, we just like threw a ton of information out at people. Where can they go to find out more and stay on top of these? Or maybe if they missed the live broadcast, although we'll be very disappointed in you if you do miss the live broadcast, where can they go to potentially catch repeats or catch stuff on demand?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. If you want to go on demand, that would be the, you know, number one. Go to AMI.ca where you can stream all of the documentaries, these ones that I just talked about and also past ones. But also subscribe to the newsletter. We've got the AMI newsletter that comes out a few days before the beginning of each month. So actually the August one is going to be going out later this morning. And that lets you know at the beginning of each month what's coming up on AMI TV, AMI Audio, our podcasts, and anything planned with our community partners. So go to AMI.ca/newsletter. You input your name, your email address, and you'll get that into your inbox a couple of days before the beginning of each month.
Greg, as you mentioned off the top of the segment, you and I have not had a chance to actually catch up much at all this summer. And really last year when you moved to Chelsea, Quebec, it was really in the midst of the pandemic, and I'm sure it was a bit strange. So what's it like having something more of a normal summer in Chelsea, Quebec? How are you enjoying that Gatineau lifestyle?
I'm really enjoying the Gatineau lifestyle. I've been able to use my grade 13 OAC French, and people have been very polite. But yeah, it's just a beautiful little community north of Gatineau called Chelsea. And yeah, I mean, delays, things that we had to have done around the house were delayed by almost a year in some cases. But now that those jobs are getting done, it's feeling a little bit more normal. And we love it. And we love the Ottawa area. I've only, you know, ever come to Ottawa on school trips to go to the Parliament buildings. And now that things are starting to open up, like the museums and the galleries, I'm going to head out and get my culture on.
That's beautiful stuff. Well, Greg, I'm looking forward to either catching up with you sometime soon in Toronto or in the Ottawa area. We can go take a hike in some beautiful nature in that neck of the woods and then retreat back to our glamping lifestyle.
This sounds good, Dave. Thanks.
That's Greg David. He's a communication specialist for AMI, and he joined us from Chelsea, Quebec. Coming up next, producer Don Dickinson will preview The Guardian this week with an article about an Alabama woman who is facing felony charges for filling a doctor's prescription while pregnant. But first, here is Canadian press reporter Karen Rebo with your morning business minutes.
North American stock markets were mixed yesterday amid a flood of earnings reports. Toronto's TSX index gained 57 points yesterday to 20,230. New York's Dow Jones average dropped 127 points, and the NASDAQ added 102. In Tokyo this morning, the Nikkei index climbed 200 points, and our dollar is trading overseas this morning a little higher at 80.13 cents U.S. Canadian Pacific Railway reported record second quarter revenues of $2.05 billion yesterday. The Calgary-based railway also reported earnings of $1.25 billion for the 3 months ended June 30th, double the profits from the same period last year. The company declared a quarterly dividend of 19 cents per share, payable in October. And concerns about a revenue growth slowdown pushed Facebook's shares lower in after-hours trading yesterday, not long after the company reported that its second quarter profits doubled to $10.4 billion, thanks to a massive increase in advertising revenue. From the Canadian Press Business Desk, I'm Karen Rebo.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's get to a preview of The Guardian this week. Of course, you can hear that reading program that airs Saturdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio and features readings from the pages of The Guardian newspaper. Dawn Dickinson is the producer of that program, and she joins us now to preview a few of this week's articles. Hey, good morning, Dawn. Great to chat with you once again.
Morning, Dave.
Dawn, I think you picked this story just for me because you know I love a good working dog story. An elite team of four canine super detectors and their Yazidi handlers are leading a groundbreaking sniff search for homemade explosive devices in the litter regions of Iraq. So, Dawn, what kind of devices are these dogs sniffing out?
Well, this is a great story, but it's for horrific reasons, you know. It turns out that these devices in Iraq, they're called VS-500 units, are about 30 centimeters wide with a plastic casing and central pressure pad. They can fit in the palm of your hand, but they contain 100 grams of explosives packed with all kinds of nasty things. The pressure pad is sensitive enough for a child to activate, even though they can be as far down as 30 centimeters of earth. So they're pretty nasty things there, Dave.
Dawn, I think the answer to this question is self-evident. As we know, the region of Iraq has been dealing with either a civil wars, internal conflict, or foreign wars for almost 40 years. But why are so many of these mines in the ground?
Yeah, well, this is the terrible thing about it. The Iraqi forces managed to take the last stronghold 4 years ago from ISIS, and the Iraqi flag was raised, and everything seemed to be going well. But the war was not over. As they were retreating, ISIS forces ceded the towns, villages, and countryside in that area with IEDs, and the job of clearing them is just is a huge job.
And we know that that sniffing dogs are not necessarily a brand new concept. We see them at airports all the time. They've been used by militaries for decades. But what makes these canines so different?
Well, yeah, they're very different. Whereas dogs are usually trained to sniff out explosives, mainly TNT, these particular IED dogs take basically it a step further. They're trained in Bosnia-Herzegovina, and their noses are actually attuned to rubber, metal, and batteries. Mm. This is key because explosives are often improvised in these poorer countries from domestic items and with detonators and batteries that are very kind of, you know, local, right? So training dogs to focus on a wider range of scents allows for more opportunities for these particular dogs to detect these other items.
Dawn, you're a dog lover. I'm a dog lover. I've always been blown away as I've been learning more about what guide dogs can do over the course of the last 10 years working for AMI, and even before that, just knowing that they could be trained in such a way and professionalized in such a way to be so so disciplined in what they do. Does it ever blow you away how much we're able to train dogs to do, especially in really important causes like this?
Oh, it's phenomenal what they can do, you know, especially in medical areas where they can. Now they're, I mean, I watched a special just the other day on dogs, you know, sniffing out cancers and sniffing out, you know, they can even detect, you know, epilepsy and various things that, I mean, all these amazing things that we have no idea how they're capable of doing it, right? But so yes, they're definitely man's best friend and woman's best friend.
Yeah, and woman's best friend too. Yeah, I was watching one about how dogs, some dogs are being trained now for individuals with diabetes so they can sniff out low blood sugar.
Yeah.
I'm like, that just blows me away. It blows me away.
Yeah,
and yet some dogs knock over the Christmas tree whenever they get the opportunity. So, you know, there's definitely a spectrum, so to speak. Hey, Don, let's jump over to another story that was really fascinating as I had a chance to give it a read. An Alabama woman is facing felony charges for filling a doctor's prescription while she was pregnant. Don, I think we need to get like the overview of this case. What are the facts of this case?
Yeah, this is really sad. Mother of six, and she suffers from severe back pain caused by a degeneration of her spinal discs. Her doctor prescribed hydrocodone, an opiate painkiller, and she started using it occasionally. And I say occasionally, when the pain became too much to handle. She stopped taking her prescription during her most recent pregnancy. But when she started to get really, really pregnant, you know, and the bump was quite large, mm-hmm. the weight added pressure on her back and the pain worsened. So midway through her third trimester, and that's important, you know, she's really lasted quite a long time in this pregnancy. She couldn't take it anymore, and she refilled the particular prescription that she was given. And she's being brought up on charges, as you said. It's pretty horrendous.
Is this a common practice for pharmacists or doctors to turn in patients who are pregnant?
Well, it's only in certain states that this even happens, right? Alabama has made it a felony to expose a child to chemical toxic environment. The law was meant, when it was brought into practice, was meant to enforce heavier penalties on people who made drugs around children. So basically, it was brought in for people who were doing meth labs, right? Mm-hmm. But prosecutors quickly began deploying the law against pregnant women, interpreting a chemical toxic environment to mean the pregnant body itself.
Ah, good old the American South. Don, this may seem a little bit immaterial, but I do want to ask the question. Did the newborn in this case test positive for the opiate?
In this particular case, yes, the son did test positive. An investigation was launched, obviously, and then that's when State Services Agency stepped in. Now, interestingly enough, Dave, the state Child Services Agency found no wrongdoing, but the local police and the district attorney decided that they were going to press on. Mm. 2 months after she gave birth, now you got to remember, this woman has seven children, right? Seven armed officers raided her home and obviously terrified the entire family, including these seven children.
What was she eventually charged with?
Well, she was charged with prescription fraud. Prosecutors alleged that she committed a crime when she failed to inform her prescribing doctor that she was pregnant before refilling her particular prescription. It's a novel charge for such a case, but Alabama has a long history of prosecuting pregnant women under a strict reading of a statute against chemical endangerment. So there you go.
Don, I feel like I have a million things to say about this, but they're almost like inarticulable, right? That like, yes. It's just like a really frustrating, really irritating story about the way that women generally are treated inside the health system, but then where the health system and the legal system contravene to really discriminate against women. It's a real burr, but I'm not even quite sure how to articulate it in all my thoughts. I might need all 2 hours of the show just to talk it out.
Well, I couldn't say what I want to say on air, Dave.
Okay, all right. So let's have a phone call after the show and we can use some four-letter words that we can't use on camera. Don, it's always a pleasure chatting with you, even when you bring us intense stories like this. Thank you for the hard work that you do. We won't talk to you next week because you're off next week. It's a long weekend here in Ontario. Whoop, whoop. And other parts of the country as well. But Don, we'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
Okay, Dave, take care.
That's Don Dickinson, producer of our reading program, The Guardian This Week, which airs Saturdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. Coming up next, I've got the accessibility story roundup. Mike has the big business story of the day, and I've got a whole whack of news stories to share with you as well. Stay right there. Now with Dave Brown, we'll be right back. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Mike Ross is standing by with the big business story of the day, but I want to share with you our accessibility story roundup. Hee-haw. This one coming to you from CBC News, written by Sabrina Jonas. The article is entitled Quebec Abandons Pilot Projects to Take Adults with Disabilities Out of CHSLDs and Blames Key Advocate. Just for the point of clarification, a CHSLD is a long-term care home, the system of long-term care homes in Quebec. The Quebec government is abandoning a pilot project that was expected to allow some adults with disabilities to move out of long-term care after it says a key activist pushing for the project shut down its proposed plans. Last summer, after going through what he thought were the proper channels to get the government to take action, Jonathan Marchand spent 5 days and five nights in a makeshift cage in front of the National Assembly to demand that those who are not elderly be allowed to move out of long-term care homes and have self-directed care instead. Last winter, after numerous negotiations, the government promised to launch a project this summer allowing five adults with disabilities to live at home and manage their own support services. But after learning this spring that the Ministry of Health and the Special Services Ministry was planning to create a group home for the five, Marchand rejected the plan. Marchand is a 44-year-old entrepreneur with muscular dystrophy. He has lived in a long-term care home in Sainte-Anne-de-Beaupré near Quebec City against his will for nearly a decade and requires round-the-clock help to monitor the ventilator he uses to breathe. He's been fighting for independence for himself and other young residents since the day he moved in. Marchand said he met with the government about 20 times over the past few months to explain the details of his demands and identify concrete solutions. He says what the government proposed was simply another form of institutionalization, so he rejected the plan, saying it was the opposite of what he's been campaigning for years. Then, 3 weeks ago, Marchand received a letter from the government telling him that the work to carry out the pilot project could no longer continue since the, quote, mandate proposed by the MSSS does not meet your expectations. Although it will not carry out the pilot project, the provincial government emphasized that it is not abandoning the plan to take people with disabilities out of long-term care homes. In a statement to CBC Montreal, Quebec's minister responsible for seniors, Marguerite Blais, says she believes people with disabilities should be able to live at home for as long as possible, but the government must be fair to everyone and is working to improve existing projects and develop innovative programs. The government notes there are alternative homes currently under construction in several regions of Quebec that will meet a large number of needs, but that's not what Marchand wants himself or for his community. Meanwhile, Parti Québécois MNA Joël Arsenault said it is unacceptable that the collaborative project between the group and Quebec ended this way. Despite the setbacks, Marchand says he has great hope in turning the tide for people with disabilities moving forward. And I'm going to finish with a quote here from him. He says, there are many ways that we can continue to have our demands be heard. We are extremely resilient and creative people. This is just the beginning. Let's head over to Mike Ross. He has the big business story of the day. So, Mike, what's crack-a-lackin' in the world of business today?
Well, it's all about Buy American, Dave.
Oh, boy.
And Joe Biden's tougher Buy American rules, excuse me, were unveiled.
You see that you bought an American cough drop, and you see what happened?
You see what happens?
If that had been a good Canadian cough drop, that wouldn't have happened.
That's not a fisherman's friend, I tell you. these new rules were unveiled. This is, of course, a tightening of the Buy American Act. And under these new rules, any goods bought by the U.S. government from vehicles to construction materials have to contain at least 75% U.S.-made content by the year 2029. That is up 20% from the 55% of today. Now, the exact value or cost that this is going to have against the Canadian market is kind of unclear. Mm. One estimate from 2015 put the figure at about $15 billion annually for the entire government system in the United States. But if you're talking specifically federal, it's about $674 million. A senior Canadian official says they're not particularly worried about these new rules because they're mostly neutralized by what the World Trade Organization has in place, which is an agreement on government procurement. Mm. And they say that under that deal, Canadian companies are exempted from Buy American requirements on most U.S. federal government contracts. So maybe a little bit of a silver lining there. But the products that Biden's administration are trying to sort of protect in the United States are the supplies of minerals such as lithium, aluminum, uranium, and potash. And basically, they're trying to make sure that American manufacturers have those items available to them from America that they're not counting on foreign markets to supply them with that, because those foreign markets can shut off at any time that they really want to and have a deep, deep impact on the American market.
But when we hear things like aluminum, potash, that immediately brings to attention places like Quebec with a strong aluminum industry, place like Saskatchewan with a strong potash industry. It does at least create that level of concern. Even when a senior official says, well, you know, it's going to be mitigated, it still gives you that feeling of what other walls do they want to put up in regards to economic isolationism.
Yep.
I promise, Mike, I won't go too deep into a rant on free trade here, but for years, people in North America warned America and Canada about these free trade agreements, saying you want to jump into free trade, just be careful what you're asking for, because there could be some disadvantages to this. And now we're starting to see what the disadvantages are, and all of a sudden those who were really pro free trade are seemingly very happy to be isolationist. It's like the chickens coming home to roost 25 years later.
Sure. And in 2009, under the Obama administration, Canada got an exemption from the Buy American Act. That exemption has not happened under Joe Biden, though the Canadian government continues to try that. No word yet, though, as to whether or not Biden is going to allow that to happen.
Mike, thank you for this.
Okay, Dave.
You know the way to my heart. You know how to get my heart palpitating talking about free trade in the morning. It's the funny things that make me tick. Thanks for this, Mike.
Okay, Dave.
Let's get to a couple news stories as we're wrapping up the hour. The BC Wildfire Service says there are 246 wildfires burning across BC this morning. Of those, 37 are considered of note, meaning they are highly visible or pose a potential threat to public safety, and 70% of all active fires in British Columbia were sparked by lightning. While lightning and wind have not been the chief instigators of activity this week, returning hot temperatures and low humidity threaten to challenge weary fire crews through Saturday. And then looking at the forest fires in Ontario, Ontario Premier Doug Ford says he will work tirelessly to help fight northern wildfires and support evacuees, but he is not declaring a state of emergency. First Nation leaders have called on Ontario to take that action. Ford says declaring a state of emergency would not add resources. It would just mean the province taking over everything.
That's the only difference, is the province will come in and say you can't go down this road. There's already emergency orders put in place, so it's not holding back any resources. We will put all the resources we have. I won't spare a penny.
Grand Chief Alvin Fiddler says there are 1,300 people in Pikun-Jikum First Nation who are waiting to be flown out, but they have nowhere to go. And then looking at the wildfires in the United States, the governors of California and Nevada are calling on more federal firefighting assistance as they toured a region blackened by one of several massive wildfires burning the American West. Reporter Will Carr reports from the scene.
The governors of California and Nevada getting a firsthand look at the aftermath of the Tamarack fire, that fire straddling both states. The governors thanking firefighters and pleading for more resources.
Cal Fire is the largest civilian aerial attack force in the world, and it's not enough.
Here in the West, these fires are being fueled by relentless heat waves. We're talking record-setting heat.
Today, California is asking consumers to conserve energy, concerned that temperatures up to 43 Celsius could threaten the power grid. And then overnight, a tsunami warning was issued for parts of Alaska after a large earthquake struck the peninsula Wednesday evening. U.S. Geological Survey geophysicist Randy Baldwin says the quake was magnitude 8.2 and hit east of Perryville, Alaska. Baldwin says although some people have reported feeling the quake, he's not expecting any damage reports.
The estimated losses or fatalities would be probably minimal, you know, if there were any at all.
The National Tsunami Warning Center says the Tembler generated a wave that was less than 30 centimeters high. Emergency Info British Columbia says there is no tsunami threat to British Columbia. Let's turn our attention to the world of politics. NDP leader Jagmeet Singh wants the Governor General to refuse any request from the Trudeau government to dissolve Parliament to call a federal election. Singh says there is no justification since the government has won every confidence vote. The Prime Minister says his government's focus has been on being there for Canadians through the pandemic and to being there as the country rebuilds.
So we've seen that even during a pandemic, even as we were able to get out historic supports for Canadians, I think Canadians deserve to have governments and parliamentarians focused on them, not focused on politicking. That's what we've been as a government, and that's what we will continue to do every single day.
and speculation about an election call continues. Staying with the Prime Minister, Ottawa is stepping in to help Newfoundland and Labrador avoid a spike in electricity rates resulting from the province's troubled Muskrat Falls hydroelectricity project. Prime Minister Trudeau announced that Ottawa is giving the province $3.2 billion from its share of the Hibernia oil field off the coast of St. John's, with another $2 billion will come from loans and guarantees and a $1 billion investment in the province's portion of the Labrador Island Link.
Our government is committed and has been committed a long time to working with Newfoundland and Labrador to make sure people in the Atlantic region have a reliable, long-term, clean source of energy. This province has a lot of hydroelectricity potential, and the projects are part of our plan to reduce emissions in Canada and fight climate change.
The money will help cover costs set to come due when the Labrador project begins generating power this November, preventing sweeping rate increases that would have been necessary to pay the bills. And while we're in the Atlantic provinces, let's talk about Nova Scotia, where Nova Scotia Liberal leader Ian Rankin was largely forced to defend his party's record on health care during the first leaders debate of the provincial election campaign. He fended off attack by Tory leader Tim Houston and NDP leader Gary Burrell. Rankin told reporters that the province was a leader in dealing with the COVID pandemic.
It's my view that we can lead in our economic recovery. That's the foundation of how we're going to be able to have enough revenue for program spending in healthcare, education, and helping those most vulnerable.
The Liberals released their party's healthcare platform on Tuesday, promising an additional $131 million to bolster the system. Progressive Conservative leader Tim Houston went after Rankin for failing to deal with a chronic physician shortage that left nearly 70,000 people without a family doctor. Houston says he was relaying concerns he's been hearing from voters.
What I hear from Nova Scotians is they're concerned about healthcare, so it's obviously been a big focus of our campaign. And I think we got the message across that there's big problems in healthcare, and the PC party is the only one that's talking about real solutions to address them. I think Nova Scotians probably saw that.
NDP leader Gary Burrell told reporters that the debate helped to clarify the difference between his party's vision and that put forward by the other parties as the province attempts to recover economically from the pandemic.
The debate really helped to clarify the difference in the two paths, between the path of coming to recovery through expansion by focusing on people's real needs and this path of going forward by contraction and taking over $200 million out of the budget next year. That's the main thing that struck me.
Nova Scotians go to the polls on August the 17th. A busy day in the world of news. We also had a lot of fun chatting over the course of this last hour. And of course, we always enjoy chatting with you. It's not just us talking amongst ourselves. You should be engaged in the conversation as well. So if you have a comment about something you hear on the show or something you think you should hear on the show, we're open to suggestion. We're open to feedback. In fact, the email address is titled feedback@AMI.ca, feedback@AMI.ca. If you put "now with Dave Brown" in the subject line, it's going to get to me a little bit faster. feedback@AMI.ca. @AMI Audio is where you find us on Twitter. @AMI Audio, Accessible Media Inc. is what you punch into your search bar on Facebook to track us down. And of course, that's Inc. with a C, not with a K, as in incorporated. Or you go ahead and pick up the phone and give us a ring, 1-866-509-4545. That's 1-866-509-4545. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI, coming to you on AMI Audio and AMI TV and AMI.ca, or you're listening on demand on your favorite podcasting platform. No matter how you've joined us today, thank you for making time. Today is Thursday, July the 29th, 2021. Coming up in the second hour of the show, Stephen Scott of Double Tap Canada will describe a new device that harvests sweat from your fingertips to generate power. Man, that is going to be a side hustle for me. I am convinced of it. And Sylvie Fiquette will share the Pacific Regional Report and chats about Camp Bowen's Virtual Connections summer programming. But let's kick off the hour by handing the microphone over to Mike Ross and the regional news update.
Thanks, Dave. We'll start in British Columbia, where they've decided not to appeal a provincial Supreme Court ruling that found the government breached the Treaty 8 agreement signed with the Blueberry River First Nations more than 120 years ago by allowing development without the community's approval. Attorney General David Eby says the court was clear the the province must improve its management of the cumulative impacts of industrial development in the territory in BC's northeast. He says the BC government recognizes that negotiation rather than litigation is the primary forum for achieving reconciliation. EB says the province has reached out to Blueberry River First Nations to start the negotiation process for building a path forward for resource development in the territory that respects the nation's treaty rights. Two of the territories in Yukon. Yukon's top doctor says there have been no new cases of COVID-19 diagnosed in the territory, the first time that's happened since June 5th. Dr. Brendan Hanley says 77 infections are active, down from 89 the day before. Vaccination clinics are returning to rural Yukon communities this week and running through the third week of August. They've also expanded vaccine eligibility to anyone born in 2009, even if they've not yet turned 12, saying it's important to get more youth between 12 and 17 immunized with the Pfizer shot before they go back to school. To the Prairies, and a United Conservative backbencher has been fined $15,000 by Elections Alberta for offenses including filing false financial statements. Devinder Tour, the legislature member for Calgary Falcon Ridge, was penalized for fundraising and spending infractions, both as a candidate for the party nomination as well as in the 2019 election. The 10 violations also include exceeding expense limits and accepting a prohibited contribution from a numbered company of which Tour had been a director. Tour, a first-time MLA, won the constituency seat by just 91 votes over the rival NDP. To Ontario, and Durham Regional Police east of Toronto have charged a retirement home's general manager for allegedly removing door handles to some units during the pandemic. Police say they got a complaint in February against Whitecliff Terrace retirement residence in Curtis. They allege staff removed some door handles during the pandemic to keep residents inside their rooms. Tawab Karimi of Oshawa has been charged with two counts of unlawful confinement. And Ontario announced its delayed revamp of the autism program will get more than $62 million this year to improve access to services. COVID-19 has reduced the capacity and the number of services offered to families, while the wait list has gotten longer. The province says initiatives like grants are expected to go to service providers to hire staff, increase hours for current employees, and travel to serve kids in rural or remote communities. And in the Atlantic region, healthcare was the hottest topic of debate last night during the first leaders' debate in the Nova Scotia provincial election campaign. Liberal leader Ian Rankin was on the defensive when his two main rivals noted the Liberal government had fallen far short of its promise to provide a doctor for every family. Progressive Conservative leader Tim Houston and NDP leader Gary Burrell both noted that almost 70,000 Nova Scotians were currently without a doctor, and that number's grown under Rankin's leadership. Rankin responded that his party's investments in healthcare had been sensible, and he suggested that the other parties were in a competition on who can throw the most money at the issue. And Nova Scotia's major political parties now have full slates of candidates for the August 17th election. The Progressive Conservatives filled their final gap by saying David Whiteman will be running in Cumberland North. The incumbent, Elizabeth Smith McCrossan, was dropped from the Tory party over her encouragement of a border blockade. But she's running again in the riding as an independent, while veteran politician Bill Casey's running for the Liberals. Meanwhile, the Liberals confirmed Leslie McKay is the candidate in Dartmouth South, where a female candidate was dropped after a dispute with the party over revealing photos of herself that she had posted online. And those are your top regional headlines going coast to coast across the country.
Thank you, Mike. We'll talk to you a little bit later in the hour. Jeff Ryman is standing by down the hall for a sports chat. Jeff, I was delighted to find out that you were in the building today. What a week it's been between Ramya being in the building a couple days ago. You're in the building today. It's like a delight for those of us in the Now with Dave Brown family, seeing other humans Delightful, delightful times. But Jeff, there's a lot of humans who are going to have a delightful night tonight when the National Basketball Association holds its draft and a bunch of kids' dreams come true as their professional career begins. Jeff, there's a lot of places to go here, but let's start with the Toronto Raptors, who have the fourth overall pick.
Yeah, this is going to be exciting, Dave. I think, you know, the last couple of drafts for the Toronto Raptors, they haven't drafted this high, I think, since they selected Jakob Poeltl a couple years back.
And that was like a ninth overall pick, right? The last time they had a pick this high was Jonas Valanciunas.
Yeah, this is the first top five pick in quite some time, maybe even a decade. Yeah, back to JV being selected fifth overall by the Raptors. So this is pretty exciting times, I think, for Toronto. I mean, there are some really, really good players that could potentially be available at number four. I feel like this is a sweet spot for the Toronto Raptors because the top four in this draft, to me, I think, are in a different tier than, you know, anything after four. But I guess we'll have to wait and see what the Raptors do tonight. But it looks like a nice guard from Gonzaga, Jalen Suggs, could very well be one of those new players being selected to the Toronto Raptors. And, of course, you know, with all those rumors surrounding Kyle Lowry, is he going to Miami? Is he going to go to L.A.? Could he potentially re-sign in Toronto? You know, with his contract and his playing status in Toronto up in the air, I think, you know, it'd be sort of a natural fit to fill that void with a guard of the future. And that's looking like what Jalen Suggs could potentially be if the Toronto Raptors draft this guy at the fourth overall position.
It's a draft where the top three players are clearly the top three players. So the Raptors got a little bit unlucky landing in that four spot, but Jalen Suggs is clearly the fourth best player in this draft. He's a great defender. He's a ferocious player. He's actually quite similar to Kyle Lowry in the way that he attacks the basket, in the way that he shoots the ball, and seemingly his mentality of playing the game. I think this is a no-brainer pick for the Raptors to pick up Jalen Suggs and unfortunately having to say goodbye to Kyle Lowry, but wishing him well on his way because if he gets a chance to join a contender and go win something, I think a lot of fans in Toronto will be very happy as they sort of begin to really crest in this new generation. And Jeff, I've seen a couple reports out there about, oh, are the Raptors shopping Pascal Siakam? Are they trying to kind of overthink this? I think that would be a mistake if you're the Raptors. I think you should look at OG Anunoby, Pascal Siakam, Fred VanVleet, and now Jalen Suggs and say, this is our young core. And with the cap space you're going to get from Kyle Lowry coming off the books, going to address your center position and going to address some of the depth issues that have been depleted over the years. I think this is actually a wonderful opportunity for the Toronto Raptors.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I feel like most of those guys you just mentioned, Pascal, OG, and Fred VanVleet, these guys are just entering the prime of their career. I mean, these guys are going to be playing at this level for the next couple of years. And I think with the Toronto Raptors in the position they're in, if they select Jalen Suggs or, you know, if Evan Mobley were somehow to drop to them as well, I would love that.
Be still my beating heart.
But Dave, these are types of guys at number four where you can just plug and play them. Normally with a draft pick in the NBA, normally they'd have to sit down for, you know, be behind a veteran for a year or two and then eventually be thrusted into that starting rotation or that starting role. With the number four pick, they're probably going to just plug and play. And you mentioned those three other guys. So having the three guys already in the NBA with that NBA experience, with all-star experience, and then you throw in a player like Jalen Suggs potentially, you know, I think that's a pretty quick rebuild for the Raptors as they didn't have a very good finish to last season.
Jeff, there are a number of teams tonight going in with multiple first round picks. The Houston Rockets have multiple first round picks. The Oklahoma City Thunder have multiple first round picks, as do the Orlando Magic. But Jeff, here's the thing. All three of those teams are in deep rebuilding mode. All three of those teams stink. There's another team with two first-round draft picks, the Golden State Warriors, who had a little bit of a down year, but they have the 7th overall pick and the 14th overall pick. Jeff, they strike me as one of the most interesting teams in the draft tonight because Steph Curry, although he's entering his mid-30s, just had an MVP-caliber season. Klay Thompson, one of the best shooters in the league, coming off multiple leg injuries, but it stands to reason he should be able to come back healthy this year. They have Canadian Andrew Wiggins, who had a career season playing for them. Draymond Green, former All-Star, really one of the best passers and defenders in the league. They have a young player, James Wiseman, playing center for them. They already have five really good pieces in place. With that 7-14, Jeff, What do you think they do? Do you think they might start drafting more veteran-style players? I'd say like older players, players who maybe played 3 or 4 years in college, entering the league at 22 to try and win now? Or do you think they might try to start taking some risks and taking high upside guys to say, well, we're going to have two generations of team here. We're going to have the now and the future.
Dave, I might go off the board here. I think they might package those picks to and maybe make a trade. I mean, those would be pretty enticing to some teams that are maybe more deep into a rebuild. Mm. I think that Golden State with those two first picks, they've also, like you mentioned, they've got some good trade bait. I know Andrew Wiggins has been, you know, floating around in some trade rumors. Even James Wiseman, I don't really know why you'd want to move on from a player like that. I think he's sort of that new breed big man in the NBA that I think a lot of teams covet. But, you know, they do have some really enticing trade bait, and I think maybe they look at the potential of trading those picks. But honestly, if I'm Golden State, I'm going with one of your theories, Dave. If they elect to keep those picks, I think maybe you pick a sophomore, a junior, or a senior in this draft, and you already have that experience factor, and they can come in and play a decent sized role. Even in Toronto, we saw it last year a little bit towards the tail end of the season with Malachi Flynn, mm-hmm, who spent you know, a couple years in college himself, and you saw him, you know, he sort of caught on towards the end of the season there and looked like a really good piece for the future for the Toronto Raptors. So if Golden State could do that, and I mean, they've already got a couple of solid pieces on their roster right now. If they could, you know, anybody who's playing behind Steph Curry is probably going to learn a ton in just, you know, a short amount of time. So if they do elect to keep those picks, Dave, I think that, you know, instead of taking a gamble on one of those players who may have been good in high school and then maybe underperformed a little bit in college and is deemed more of a potential piece or a project piece, maybe they do go with that, you know, surefire who has at least had the accolades in college and really would be able to play meaningful minutes, I think, early on in their NBA careers.
Yeah, the expression that people use when talking about that is sort of the high floor, low ceiling, right? That a lot of times during the NBA draft, everybody thinks, oh, we're going to be the team that finds Giannis Antetokounmpo, even though there's really only been one Giannis Antetokounmpo ever in terms of that ability. But I mean, I'm being a bit jest. Obviously, players like Nikola Jokic, this year's MVP, was also a second round pick. So it's not impossible to find sort of these high ceiling guys. But if you're a team like Golden State who thinks that you can compete, someone like Davion Mitchell from Baylor, who just won a national championship, who's a really effective defender, he's a good shooter, he comes in and sort of plays for you on day one as a player who was a junior, right? As a player who's had 3 or 4 years playing college basketball and has developed his game, a little bit less of a raw project, maybe never going to be an MVP, but he's someone who you can sort of plug and play tomorrow.
Yeah.
Jeff, we can always plug and play you at the AMI Sports Desk. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Enjoy the draft, Dave.
Thank you, sir. That's AMI's Jeff Ryman. He's at the AMI Sports Desk. The NBA draft will be tonight. I believe it starts at 8 p.m. Eastern time on TSN. Might be 7:30. You know what? Just tune in at 7 o'clock and watch the pre-draft show, and you can hear a bunch of people who know nothing talk about everything. Okay, that's mean. That's mean to my broadcasting brethren. But seriously, the NBA draft is such a crapshoot. It's so much fun. Okay, you know what's fun? Catching up with Nazreen Abdel-Majid at the AMI Weather Desk.
Thanks, Dave. Here is your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada. Corner Brook cloudiness increasing, 60% chance of showers, high of 18. Charlottetown mainly sunny with a high of 23. St. John sunny, high of 18. Quebec City mainly sunny, cloudiness increasing with a high of 24 and a humidex of 26. In Toronto, cloudy showers, there's a risk of a thunderstorm, then hazy, high of 22 and a humidex of 27. Sault Ste. Marie, mainly cloudy, 70% chance of showers, there's a risk of a thunderstorm, then hazy, high of 23 and a humidex of 28. In Brandon, mainly sunny, high of 29 and a humidex of 30. Regina, sunny, mix of sun and clouds with a chance of showers, there's a risk of a thunderstorm, then hazy, high of 25 and a humidex of 28. Lethbridge, mix of sun and clouds, clearing, then hazy with a high of 32 and a humidex of 37. Red Deer, we're expecting a mix of sun and clouds, becoming sunny, fog patches, then hazy with a high of 29 and a humidex of 33. Whitehorse, mainly sunny with a high of 22. In Kelowna, sunny, some smoke locally with a high of 35. And in Vancouver, sunny, high of 26 and a humidex of 30. And that was your AMI National Weather Report from Environment Canada.
Thank you very much, Nazreen. We'll talk to you a little bit later in the hour. Coming up next, Stephen Scott of Double Tap Canada will describe a new device that harvests sweat from your fingertips to generate power. Gosh, I need to know more about this. Thankfully, he is coming up next. But first, travel apps are being accused of discrimination against LGBTQ plus people. Here's Michelle Franzen with Tech Trends.
A study from Trinity College found gay couples were 25% more likely to be rejected from a booking on Airbnb. Consumer Reports' Brian Vine says they found the bias can take on many forms.
From being ignored when they make requests to book a place, to outright discrimination when they show up.
Airbnb, Vrbo, and Flipkey ask you to list personal information in your profile, which Vine says can be used to discriminate against certain users. As a result, services like FabStays have cropped up, catering specifically to LGBT travelers.
If that's something that they can do and get the same great stays without a side of homophobia, I imagine lots of people will engage with them.
With Tech Trends, I'm Michelle Franz in ABC News.
Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. The whole crew is standing by, so when I get an opportunity like that, I say, well, let's have a little bit of fun. So, found a dad joke on social media that I'm going to pass around the table, and you guys are going to tell me whether this is funny or it's not funny. So we have Sam standing by, Mike standing by, Nazreen and Ramya standing by. Now this comes from my friend Pete Patipko, who's a morning show host in Edmonton. So dad joke goes as such. The winner of the javelin at the Olympics should not get a medal. They should get a trophy. Sam, thumbs up, thumbs down.
I like it. It's a there's fun involved with it, but I think that for me, I have to go something like something even more similar and basic and kind of cringy. Like, where does Napoleon keep his armies? In his sleeveys.
Okay. All right. See? All right. I'm giving you the thumbs down with your lack of enthusiasm. Let's bring in Nazreen Abdelmajid. Nazreen, what do you make of that dad joke?
Both of them were cringe worthy. Okay. That's what it was. I'm sorry. I have to admit it. Even though I'm really a dad joke kind of person. I throw that around all the time, but I'm sorry. Yours does not win it.
What do you call an alligator in a vest?
What?
An investigator.
Oh, that was actually good.
There you go. I got the thumbs up eventually. Ramya Amuthan, what do you make of that dad joke about the winner of the javelin not getting a medal but a trophy?
Yeah, didn't like that one. Didn't love Sam's either, but I liked the last one, along with Nazreen. I think maybe if you laughed after telling the joke, Dave, it would help.
Yeah.
Okay.
It would spice it up.
I've got to put my own material over. I understand this. Mike, what do you think of the dad joke around the javelin for getting a trophy?
Well, I got to be honest with you. My wife accuses me of not only telling dad jokes, but she says granddad jokes. So I got to be very honest with you about that joke you just told, Dave. That was absolutely...
Double thumbs down.
That was horrible.
Ooh, Siskel and Ebert came to get me there. All right, let's go back to Nazreen Abdelmajid for the entertainment reports. My joke failed to entertain the masses, but Nazreen, what's going on in the world of entertainment this morning?
So it did fail. I'm sorry. I had to admit it. I can't.
It's okay.
I have to be truthful.
It's okay. You're allowed to be honest. That's what the show is all about.
There's so many dad jokes you can tell. So that's okay. Next time.
Okay.
I'll rate every time.
I'll aspire to do better.
It's the end of the line for Arthur, and it really hurts to say this, to report this. PBS is pulling the plug on the animated Aardvark and His Friendly Family after 25 seasons. Word of the end of production comes from Kathy Wo, an original developer of the show. She tells a podcast that production on the series has ended, with the show's wrap party being held in two years ago. Wo says she feels PBS made a mistake in ending the show and wishes it would reconsider. But for now, the network says it will continue to air reruns of the show. And for that, I haven't watched it in so long, but that was my show coming
was
back.
Okay.
That coming back from school, 4 o'clock, I would turn it on. It would play about 4 episodes, and that was my show. I loved Arthur so much.
It's funny. Our producer, Andrika Delanerol, sent us an email yesterday saying, "Oh, look at this. Arthur got canceled." And I was kind of like, Arthur was still on the air. People care about Arthur. What's Arthur? I think it's just a little bit after my time. So if it's 25 years old, I would have been 13 when it came out. So it was just sort of a little after my time.
I understand where you're coming from. And I haven't watched it in years, obviously, but just the thought of it ending and eventually it will stop airing reruns on of the show. It's kind of sad. It's kind of sad. And I haven't watched any of the new episodes. I have no idea what is going on in the new episodes. I feel behind, and I am, but it's kind of sad for like a childhood show to just disappear.
Yeah. These little fragments, these things that were part of us sort of vanished and come to
an end.
What
was your show though?
I guess coming home from school, I used to watch a lot of like Garfield. I loved the Garfield show where he'd kick poor Odie off the table and eat a bunch of lasagna. I also used to love the show on PBS called Square One. It was like a mathematics show because I'm a loser, but.
is it the one with a bunch of shapes and they're doing math?
I can't speak to the modern iteration, but like, yeah, there was always a bunch of like different little math puzzles and storylines going on. So I used to like that. And Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego was one that I used to watch a lot as well, because I was kind of a geography buff and I like maps.
I love that.
Yeah. So I was a nerd. I watched nerdy
people wish
shows.
To be nerds.
Yeah, being a nerd is now awesome. So, you know, like what you like. And, earlier in the week you were asking me, like, what life advice would I give to a younger Dave?
Yes.
I would also tell him, like what you like and don't be ashamed.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Deep cut right there. Hey, Nazreen, thank you for this. I'm sorry your show got canceled, even though you haven't watched it in years. And it probably got canceled because you individually weren't watching it. They were like, we lost Nazreen. We're done here.
That would be true. I think I was the number one fan back then.
You don't need to take the blame. It's okay. I'm just yanking your chain. And Nazreen, stay right there because you're also going to tell us what's trending. What are people posting about this morning on social media?
So one of Canada's top trends is hashtag Alberta. You've mentioned this, Dave, in your news stories earlier. Albertans who test positive for COVID-19 will no longer be required to enter isolation starting in less than 3 weeks, the province's chief medical officer of health said yesterday. And according to CBC, Dr. Dina Hinshaw said during a news conference that while a recent rise in COVID-19 cases has caused some anxiety, increasing vaccination rates are limiting the threat of severe outcomes and strains on the healthcare system. As a result, the province will start making COVID-19 protocols similar to those who have a flu. And changes to certain rules and protocols will take place in two phases. And under phase one, starting Thursday, anyone with COVID-19 symptoms or who receives a positive test result must isolate, but quarantine for their close contacts will be recommended and not mandatory. So anyone who tests positive will be notified. Otherwise, it's not their responsibility.
It's COVID-19 is becoming a complicated conversation because of the effectiveness of vaccines and what vaccines are meant to prevent, which is largely hospitalization and severe outcomes like death. That said, even though these vaccines are there and they do offer an enormous amount of protection for that, we still should be a little bit concerned about community spread. And this policy, although I do not pretend to know more about science than Dr. Dina Hinshaw or Alberta Science Table. Again, we keep having these conversations about what provinces are doing, where I don't want to use the word cavalier, but I cannot find a better word than that, where it just seems like we should be handling things with still a little bit of precaution. You know,
it doesn't make sense at this point.
That they threw the Calgary Stampede, and there's roughly 100 cases that have been linked to the Calgary Stampede, although they said, the health officials said, we can't really know how much community transmission took place after those 100 cases happened. So it's just one of these things where obviously we need to be having robust, holistic conversations about where we stand with COVID. But when we see policies like this, when we say, well, there's no more isolation required, we're not too worried about spread, Well, as cases are ticking up, Alberta now has almost as many active cases as Ontario with a third of the population. They had more new cases yesterday than Ontario with only a third of the population. It's just one of these things where I don't want to pretend that I know more than the scientists, but purely from an optics point of view, it just seems like it's a little bit risky, or at least it's lacking in precaution.
I was, and I totally agree with you. I feel like it just makes no sense. And why does it have to get so much worse before we can realize that, you know, we need to take more precaution? And again, I agree with you. I don't have that certification. I'm not qualified to talk about COVID-19 facts. I don't have the information. I don't study that. But the fact that, okay, phase two, mask mandates will be lifted. Isolation hotels and quarantine support will no longer be available. The government said public health will focus on investigating severe outcomes that require hospitalization as well as any COVID-19 deaths. So basically what they're saying is we will investigate when you die. And you're putting so many children at risk when it comes to that. And I understand a lot of people want to get out of the situation of, you know, wearing masks and being in a bubble and everything, but it's still not done. And we're getting the numbers are rising again. Yeah. So
it's definitely not over. It's definitely not over. Like that's something that,
what are you doing?
For sure. Like we've seen over 1,000 active cases added in the last week in Canada, you know, like these stats matter. Nazreen, thank you for bringing this to us. I'm glad you did. I'm super glad you did.
Thank you so much.
That's Nazreen Abdel-Majid with What's Trending. Let's head over to Mike Ross to check in on this day in history, the now of then.
Let's go back to July 29th, 1938, and ABC anchor Peter Jennings was born in Toronto.
Oh, he's so good. He was so good at his job.
He was the sole anchor of ABC's World News Tonight from 1983 until 2005, passing away in August of 2005 from complications of lung cancer. 1971, the Olin family of Halifax presented the Blue Nose 2, a replica of the original Blue Nose, to the Nova Scotia government as a floating museum. And my fellow Ottawans will remember this. 1984, Ottawa chef and caterer Linda Tom won Canada's first Summer Olympics gold medal in 16 years. She claimed the women's sport pistol title on the first day of competition at the Games in Los Angeles. And those are your events and happenings this day in history.
And here we are in 2021, and Canada's women's athletes are absolutely killing it in Tokyo, doing an awesome job bringing in all kinds of hardware. Mike, I know everybody has their own favorite sort of evening news anchor across the board, especially of that era. You know, people loved their Dan Rather. I just thought people liked their Tom Brokaw, but there was something about Peter Jennings. I just loved the way he delivered the news. I know it's, you know, it's not, it shouldn't be about strictly someone's voice or how they sound or how they deliver, but there was something about Peter Jennings that every night at 6:30, I just did not want to miss that broadcast.
But part of that trustworthiness that we have in our anchors, I think part of it is their voice, is their delivery and how they talk to us, right? That they're not putting themselves above us, that they're actually talking to us or with us. I think that is one of the reasons why someone like Peter Mansbridge and Lloyd Robertson were so good on the national news here in Canada.
Absolutely, for sure. Hey, Mike, thank you for this.
Okay, Dave.
That's Mike Ross with This Day in History, the Now of Then. Let's look to this afternoon when Kelly and Company hits the airwaves at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. And Ramya Amuthan is the co-host of that show, and she joins us now. Hey, good morning, Ramya.
Morning, Dave.
Ramya, just before we jump into what's coming up this afternoon on the show, I do want to ask you our daily poll, which folks can find at AMI Audio on Twitter, Accessible Media Inc. on Facebook. Ramya, have you been tempted to try out outdoor fitness classes? Yes, no, or you'd like to?
I would probably like to, but it depends. You know, last night, my friends and I were talking about goat yoga. I've never really found appeal in that. Maybe like aquatics or something.
I like goats. I don't need them like stomping all over me while I'm trying to do a downward dog.
Well, I just can't take it seriously. I can't take the yoga part seriously.
Okay. But we can take the goat cuddling seriously. Absolutely. Yeah. Ramya, what do you guys have coming up on the show this afternoon?
Fern Lillen from the UK is going to highlight a scheme designed to encourage and, engage young people from all UK communities to explore their possibilities in Olympic and Paralympic sports. And she's going to give us some examples of people who've got to perform at the Paralympics because of this scheme. Super excited to learn about this. Also, we're learning about this Emancipation Day this year, which is on August 1st. You can experience a week of digital activities from the Ontario Heritage Trust that celebrate and explore Ontario's Black communities and Black heritage. We're actually going to learn more about this with Stephen Cook, who's the site manager of Uncle Tom's Cabin Historic Site. Plus, we're going to be on a lighter note, flipping through quirky stories from around the globe with Jeff Ryman on What in the World.
Oh, Jeff Ryman in the building today, by the way, Ramya. It was wonderful to see Jeff. I got to see you earlier this week. I got to see Jeff today. It's like Christmas in July, literally Christmas in July for me to get to see some familiar faces. You mentioned goats, and I think I've told the story on the show before, but I did an AMI TV story a couple years ago at Bee Meadows Farm in Ottawa, or in the Ottawa area, which is a rescue farm for abandoned farm animals or farm animals that needed rescuing. And there was this one goat, Annabelle. They let me into the goat pen, and Annabelle just came up right to me and started headbutting my leg and looking for pets on her head and scratches on her back. And she started chewing my cargo pocket on my cargo shorts. I just loved Annabelle. And the owner of that farm, Natalie Rowe, eventually mailed me a picture of Annabelle, which I still keep up in my apartment to this day.
That's so lovely. I know you're good with animals because when you first met Glizzy, you got right down there with him and he was just like, who is this guy? I love him. So,
yeah, and I think that's why a bunch of my neighbors hate me. I think one of my neighbors yelled at me about petting their dog the other day, but I was like, what am I supposed to do? Your dog lunged at me, started licking me. Of course I'm going to start headbutting your dog back.
They should pay attention to the dogs.
Yeah, they should just like give me their dog. If they don't like me touching their dog, they just give me their dog.
Yeah,
why not? It's my dog. You would take it. Yeah, exactly. It's finders keepers. Ramya, have yourself a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Bye, Dave.
That's Ramya Amuthan. She is the co-host of Kelly & Company, which comes your way 2 p.m. Eastern Time on AMI Audio. Coming up after the break, Sylvie Fiquette will share her Pacific Regional report and chat about Camp Bowen's virtual connections summer programming. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. Let's head out west for the Pacific Regional Report with Sylvie Fiquette, a content development specialist for AMI, who joins us from beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia. Hey, Sylvie, how are you?
Hi, Dave. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very well. Nice to chat with you. Now, I say Vancouver is beautiful. You know it's even more beautiful than Vancouver. It's Bowen Island. So you want to tell us about a place called Camp Bowen, where a virtual connections summer program is offering all kinds of programs for folks. So give us a little background on Camp Bowen and who their programs are targeted to.
Yeah, Dave. Camp Bowen was established in 1963 on Bowen Island in BC by the Canadian Organization of the Blind and Deafblind with a mission to provide summer independence building camps. And whether it's swimming independently for the first time or just meeting like-minded people, Bowen is a sanctuary where blindness and deafblindness are not barriers, and campers are encouraged to reach their full potential. And you nailed it. It is one of the most beautiful places to visit, just short 20-minute ferry ride from Vancouver. So as the world prepares to reopen later this year, Camp Bowen looks forward to returning to in-person camps in 2022. However, the Camp Bowen team is excited to be sharing virtual connections this summer, opening the door for many participants from across the country to become involved online.
So what are some of these virtual activities they have planned for August?
Yeah, in August, the Camp Bowen team will hold a virtual music camp for teens and adults. Aspiring artists, composers, and music lovers can connect for fun in this creative virtual space. Whatever your level of experience is, whether you like exploring new types of music, or maybe you've wanted to write a song, you're encouraged to register for Music Camp, which is billed as an exciting program. Mm. And you'll have the opportunity to collaborate with other artists from across the country And each of the four sessions will be followed by an opportunity to get together with fellow virtual campers, whether to play, you know, virtual trivia games or just simply to socialize. It's going to be a fun opportunity.
Oh, for sure. So what are the dates on this and how can folks register?
Yeah, this pro camp is virtual camp is offered for free and it takes place August 10th, 12th, 24th and 26th with two bonus music trivia sessions on August 17th and 19th. The sessions run from 3 to 5 p.m. Pacific to through, sorry, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern as well. The social interaction components will be divided by age brackets, so into teen and adult groups. And for registration, people can visit campbowen.ca/camps/virtual. They'll provide Zoom and telephone call-in details when people register.
And of course, for folks out listening, Bowen is spelt B-O-W-E-N. But if you didn't get that written down fast enough, no sweat. Head over to the blog after the show, ami.ca/nowblog. That information will be there for you as well. Hey, Sylvie, let's take a couple minutes to talk about a new AMI miniseries that's going to be airing called Changing Lane. What's the premise of this show?
Yeah, so AMI's production partners, Ascent Films, based in Kelowna, they've done a few Our Community episodes for us, like Joy of Sailing and Joy of Expression. They've produced Changing Lanes, an AMI original three-part documentary miniseries, which tells the stories of three people who have lost or are in the process of losing their eyesight. We'll learn through their personal journey how they're working to discover new ways of continuing living their lives to the fullest, whether their vision loss is gradual through a degenerative condition or from an accident. Each story brings a unique perspective to the audience on individual adaptations, patience and perseverance in navigating their world. They offer very authentic representation of someone who has lost their eyesight and what their journey looked like.
Sylvie, we've only got about 90 seconds here, but give us a sneak peek of some of the characters we're going to meet on the show.
Yeah, in the first episode, we'll meet Luke Jukes, a young electrician. He was on his way to his job site in the Okanagan and had a serious car accident which caused his vision loss. He was an avid outdoorsman who loved ocean adventure, diving and kayaking, and came to the realization while in recovery that his life changed in an instant and the road ahead would be difficult and uncertain. But this is such a great story. You won't want to miss it. He's a West Coast swing dancer now.
Oh.
And actually, he's an instructor. He cuts up the dance floor in Kelowna and teaches others his passion for the dance form.
I love that. A little bit of dancing and happy feet there. So, Sylvie, when does this first episode air? When can we catch the show?
Yeah, you can catch our new original series, Changing Lanes, on AMI TV starting Thursday, August 12th at 7:30 p.m. Pacific or 10:30 p.m. Eastern, or tune in on AMI TV's free app anytime or go to our website, ami.ca.
Sylvie, we've only got about 30 seconds here, but I just want to check in on how you guys are doing. I know the heat wave has been quite extreme in Vancouver. There's the forest fires blazing elsewhere in BC, and there's been very little rain going on. How's everybody holding up on the ground over there?
Yeah, there's a little bit more preparation this time around. It's been bearable and it's been fine this last week, but the weather and news is alerting people to try to stay calm and cool and, take those cold showers and try to, it is going to heat up here significantly. I don't think we'll see anything like the heat dome, but it's definitely warming up this week, especially in the Fraser Valley and in the interior.
Sylvie, stay safe. It's always nice chatting with you.
Great chatting with you, Dave. Have a great day.
That's Sylvie Fiquette, Content Development Specialist for AMI. Join us from Vancouver, BC. It's all the time we have for the show today. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, I'm Dave Brown reminding you to play safe, play fair, but don't forget to have some fun.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.